Welcome to our paranormal afterlife.
This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife remastered episode. I'm your host, Simon Bowne. I've recently gone back and listened to some of the older episodes, and I was reminded just how much valuable, relevant insight they still offer. So I'm going to be re-releasing one episode each week, now with updated and remastered audio for a much better listening experience. In this episode, I'm talking to Richard Estep. We focus on his book, The Devil's Coming to Get Me, The Haunting of Malvern Manor. Richard is an author, paranormal investigator, and TV personality. You may have seen him on TV's Haunted Case Files, Haunted Hospitals, Paranormal Revenge, Paranormal Night Shift, Paranormal 911, Destination Fear, or A Haunting.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for coming onto the podcast. It's very kind of you to give us your time.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here, Simon.
I wanted to start off by asking you about your work. You're an emergency medical technician, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a paramedic, which is the advanced life support level of emergency medical technician.
What I wanted to ask was if you've ever seen anything within your work, because one of my previous guests was a nurse in an intensive care unit for 17 years. What she saw there led her on to study near-death experiences, and now she's got a PhD. And I was wondering if you've seen anything which would suggest near-death experience or terminal lucidity or deathbed visions?
You know, I haven't personally experienced that as part of what I do, but tangentially I have. A good friend of mine, a young chap named Kyle Stormack, it's his birthday today, so happy birthday, Kyle. He's 24 years old and he has terminal cancer, unfortunately, and he's now in the palliative stage. There is no cure. And I met him through his dad because I teach at a paramedic academy. I lecture there. And Kyle is just the most remarkable young man. He's an honorary Navy SEAL to show you what kind of a fighter this young chap is. And the reason his dad got in touch with me was because Kyle had spent most of his life, well, most of the past 13, 14 years at Children's Hospital. And a number of the children that he became friends with, almost all of them have passed on. They've since died. And Kyle has begun to receive visitations from them in his room at night. And in addition to that, he received a visit from two human-shaped glowing figures, as he described it. Now, this is his third time going through this particular type of cancer. It went into remission twice. And when he was visited by these two glowing figures, one of them said to him, "The third time will be the last time." And he's absolutely convinced that he's due to pass on very, very soon, which is what the doctors have told him, and that these figures are essentially watching over him, as are some of the spirits of the children that he shared hospital time with. So he's a remarkable young man, and he tells his story with complete lucidity and immense detail, and he's not remotely scared of dying. That's what impressed me. He doesn't complain at all. He doesn't like the pain that's associated with it, but he does find these nocturnal visits, which are still going on and getting more frequent, to become a real comfort.
Yeah, this is classic deathbed visions description. It's very comforting for the people, isn't it?
It is, and something similar happened to my mom. I'm a Leicester lad originally before I came to the States. My mom, who developed terminal cancer back in 2003, died in a hospice called Loros, which if anybody from Loros is listening, you people are the closest thing to angels on this earth. I have absolute respect and appreciation for what you do and anybody that works in palliative end-of-life care. And the doctor told me with a very matter of in her final days, my mom was having fully lucid, one-sided conversations with people that nobody else could see, but which she said were the spirits of dead family members, aunts, uncles, and her parents, who, again, seemed to have come back to help ease her transition.
That was good for her to get that comfort.
It is. And I know that from a physiologic perspective, as a medical professional, you're always looking for medical explanations first before a paranormal one, which is very appropriate. Many people have claimed that the deathbed vision or near-death experience, call it what you will, is really the brain's own way of, I guess, fooling us and easing our passage into death. It's a comforting mechanism, but I'm not entirely sure that I buy that as an explanation.
Personally, I wouldn't, but I've spent years reading up on near-death experiences and people now who've experienced them, and there are things, verifiable information that they bring back from their near-death experience, information they care, you know, in a what would be a normal way.
I was going to say, to me, the most fascinating experiences are those that occur with patients in cardiac arrest, where the brain enters a low or a zero flow state in terms of blood supply. The brain does not do well without blood, as we know. So there are instances of patients that were in this low blood supply state for prolonged, usually they're hypothermic patients, patients who are very cold. And when the brain has little to no blood, it should not be capable of getting coherent thought. And yet they come back with these narratives of having been to a place, and I'm sure you're very familiar with how common these narratives are, Simon. They go to a place which is very familiar, very comforting. They're met by deceased family members, all the classic, I don't want to call them symptoms, but characteristics of the near-death experience. And there are accounts of some of them even reporting to resuscitation teams exact things that they have said over the body of their own body.
Yeah, things they couldn't have known that because they were brain dead. So how did they get that information? That's the big question, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And one of the things I find most fascinating about it is that traditionally medicine has always believed that mind arises from brain. In other words, the organic machine gives birth to brain, to thought process, to consciousness. And once it's gone, we're gone forever. And there are some physicians now that are entertaining the idea that brain may in fact be a receiver for mind. That's all. So in the same way that my TV set is off right now, but if I were to switch it, you know, there are 1,001 stories being broadcast over the airwaves on different frequencies that my TV could tune into, you know, and in the same way, it's being theorized that brain may do the same thing, that it may simply be nothing more than a receiver for what is really the seat of our consciousness, which originates elsewhere. And I find that to be very plausible.
You've got several books published. They're available on Amazon. You write up your experiences you've had when you've been doing your paranormal investigations. Is that how you describe yourself, a paranormal investigator?
I am a paranormal investigator. I have been for quite a few years. I think that as I progress, as time goes on, I've become as much a storyteller as anything else. It's not possible now for me to personally investigate every claim that that I hear about. So for example, when I wrote The World's Most Haunted Hospitals, which seemed a natural to write because I work in the healthcare field, I interviewed people that had worked in and had investigated some of the world's most haunted hospitals. And it wasn't entirely possible for me to visit each one and assess their claims for myself. Some of them are no longer open. Some of them are no longer even standing. So I've become, I think, as much of a storyteller as an investigator now, but my bread and butter and my passion is still trying to find those answers.
One of the good stories that you tell about the haunted hospital was when you went through a cardiac arrest because there was a spirit there that might not like the way you did it. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, it may have been poor form actually for me to do, but it seemed like an excellent way to generate a response. Essentially, we were investigating an old former community hospital in Utah, one of my favorite locations. In fact, I'm due back there next weekend to do some investigation. And I'd heard stories that the emergency department was haunted by supposedly the spirit of a physician had worked there during his lifetime. And this man, by all accounts, had a very low tolerance for fools, did not suffer fools gladly. So it was either his way or the highway. You know, there are many physicians that are like that. And he'd been known to be particularly disapproving of what was happening with the hospital now because the new owners had turned it into a full contact haunted house type attraction. You know, those kind of places where you go there over the Halloween period, you wander through, you get thrills and chills, you know, zombies jump out at you, those kind of things. And he seems very much not to like what the new owners have done with this. So many of the customers had complained when they came through. They said, I enjoyed the experience, but the actor you have playing the doctor in the emergency department seemed very nasty. Seemed like, you know, he was genuinely angry with us. And of course, the owners would have to say, we don't have anybody playing a doctor in the emergency department. So it seemed to me that a good way to engage with him would be to simulate a cardiac arrest. And because he was very much a perfectionist, I wanted to have everything possible go wrong. So I brought in the mannequin, the dummy that we use to train new paramedics and EMTs, brought in a cardiac monitor, brought in some expired medications, IV setups, airway intubation equipment, all the things that I would use in reality to run a cardiac arrest. And after briefing my team, who consisted of several other nurses and paramedics who'd come along to help investigate, we performed a cardiac arrest simulation that was essentially a clown show. If it could go wrong, we made sure that it went wrong. And so we would miss IVs and miss those drugs and all those kind of things. And I would simulate and getting angrier and angrier with my team. And they would push back until, you know, you could feel the tension in the room rising. Most of it was acting, but not all of it was. We were starting to get a little bit irritated with one another. And finally, I pronounced our mock patient dead. I threw down my stethoscope and I flounced out with high drama, slamming through the double doors, which I've always wanted to do. It's a very Hollywood thing to do, and you would never dream of doing it in real life, of course. And went along the corridor to go fetch my radio from the security room. And as I did so, one of the heavy wooden doors, which usually are chocked open, slammed itself just inches behind me after I passed through it. And it seemed to me a very clear indicator that somebody was not too pleased with the way I'd been behaving, and deservedly so.
And did that scare you?
I'll be honest with you, it really did, or at least it made me feel as though I'd been expressly targeted, which again, if you behave in the manner in which I was simulating behaving, it was entirely merited.
And do you get scared when you're doing many of these investigations, or have you got you quite a calm guy with this sort of thing?
It's rare. I mean, it does happen on occasion. Fear's a funny thing. It's a very subjective thing. I spent 15 years in the fire service going into burning buildings, which really didn't scare me a great deal. And yet the fear of the unseen, the fear of the unknown, does creep up on you from time to time. And I moved into a house that I'm sure your listeners in the UK are very familiar with, 30 East Drive in Pontefract, for a week in order to research that particular Matthew, who is in the military. He's an infantryman. He and I rarely get to catch up because we live on different sides of the Atlantic. So he dropped into Pontefract, and not a fan of ghosts, my brother. He can be shot at all day without breaking too much of a sweat, but doesn't like haunted houses. So I managed to talk him into, with the help of my niece and nephew and his wife, managed to talk him into coming for a brief 5-minute look around 30 East Drive. And he was like a cat on a hot tin roof. He said, there's just something in here I don't like. I don't know how you can spend the night here. And every so often I do get that feeling myself. It's no apparent reason, but it's rare that it happens.
And can you tell us about your investigations at Fairfield?
Fairfield Inn. So for the longest time since I was a youngster, I've been fascinated with the American Civil War, especially Gettysburg. There's something about the Battle of Gettysburg that has always intrigued me. And so I've investigated there a number of times, and the opportunity came for me to investigate a place called the Fairfield Inn, which is just a few miles outside of town. And it's built on the site of a cavalry engagement, which happened on the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg. A lot of American cavalrymen, I should say Union soldiers, were cut down by their Confederate counterparts because they rode right into an ambush. And were chopped to pieces, effectively. And it turned out that the Fairfield Inn, as it now is, was pressed into service as a field hospital for those wounded and dying soldiers at the end of the battle. And they've had reports of paranormal activity for years. If your listeners watch a program on television called Ghost Lab with the Kling brothers out of Texas, Brad and Barry investigated and got some incredible results at the Fairfield Inn, including a Class A EVP that was very, very clear indeed. And they got a photograph of a shadowy figure in one older part of the inn. So they recommended I investigate there, and we were able to arrange for me and a small team to spend nights investigating at the Fairfield Inn. And in addition to that, we expanded our scope and did some research on the battlefield itself, which yielded its own results. So I wrote about that in a book called The Fairfield Haunting on the Gettysburg Ghost Trail. And I'm excited to be back there in 3 weeks doing a benefit for the Wounded Warrior Foundation.
And did you have any great results there?
You know, we did. One thing that was particularly interesting is that one of the only inns I've ever stayed at where nobody lives on site but the guests. There's no, the owners live off site. So you're given a door code, which is unique to you. You punch that into the front door, and nobody else can get in or out other than the staff. So one night we'd been doing some investigation. We'd had Brad and Barry Kling phone in. And as they were talking to us on the phone, we recorded the sound of footsteps outside in the empty hallway, which was always nice to get that kind of validation. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, we called it a night because we were tired, and we actually wanted to be on the battlefield at dawn, at sunrise, in order to do some research there. So only two of us were spending the night in the inn. It's myself and my colleague, Catelyn. And I had a room at the back of the inn. She had a room at the front. So we went our separate ways about 4:15 or so, went to sleep. I drifted off fairly quickly, and I woke up at 5 o'clock, almost 5 o'clock on the nose, and I heard this terrific slam. It was what sounded like the front door slamming. So I thought, I looked at my watch and I thought, well, the chef's in early because he would come in to prepare breakfast, but usually came in about 7. But I just cracked one eye. I was very tired. I thought, the chef's in early. He's kind of loud. And I stupidly, I went back to sleep. The next morning, I met Catelyn at breakfast, and she said something strange had happened to her in the night. She said, I woke up at 4:55 and I was ice cold. I was bundled up in the blankets and I was freezing, absolutely shivering. And when I'd gone to bed, I was perfectly warm. You know, it was good, thick bedding, a quilt cover. And then I heard the door slam downstairs. And I said, yeah, I heard that too. So I assumed it was the chef coming in. Well, we talked to everybody that worked there, and none of them had entered the Fairfield Inn until 9 o'clock that morning. The chef actually had come in kind of late, knowing that there was nobody had come in. No other customers had codes that would have worked. None of the staff codes had been used. And we recorded the sound of that door slamming pretty violently. So somehow the door managed to open itself. Slam closed at exactly the same time that Catelyn was feeling this freezing cold sensation. And it's nice when the evidence dovetails like that, when you get a physical and an audible manifestation at the same time.
Is there a website where we can hear these recordings and hear the EVPs?
Absolutely. I post them over at my blog. It's at www.richardestep.net. And you'll find them on my blog posts. The Fairfield Inn was last November. And also on that same trip, we'd made a pilgrimage to what's called Pickett's Charge, which is probably the bloodiest ground at Gettysburg. The short version for those that don't know the history is that on the final day of the battle, on day 3 in the afternoon, the Confederates, who were kind of on the ropes after the first 2 days of fighting, they'd thrown themselves at the Union defenses and had been beaten back every time, never quite got far enough to call it. And Lee decided that he was going to throw 15,000 of his best soldiers right at the center of the Union line. He figured that the left flank had been too strong for him. The right flank had been too strong for him. No army could be strong everywhere. So he had to assume that the Union army was weak in the center. But what he didn't know was that his counterpart, General Meade, had reinforced the center the night before. So he was sending 15,000 of his best men into the teeth of the strongest part of the Union line. And of those men, half of them were cut down on this stretch of ground, which is now known as Pickett's Charge. And the other half were, most of them were wounded. They managed to limp back to the Confederate lines. So Pickett's Charge is the place where most Gettysburg aficionados or enthusiasts always want to visit. And the atmosphere there is truly melancholy. It's absolutely clustered with regimental monuments and stones and things like that. You can walk there. You can walk along designated foot trails in the footsteps of those Confederate soldiers. And so my colleagues, Jason and Catlin, and I did just that at sunrise one morning, and we took digital voice recorders with us. It was very, very quiet indeed. You know, no wind or anything along those lines for the most part. Very little traffic on the roads. We didn't hear or experience anything unusual, but we asked the usual EVP questions. And it was only on review that you hear what sounds like cannon fire in the distance, pretty distinctly cannon fire. Now, Pickett's Charge was preceded by the largest artillery bombardment ever conducted on the North American continent at that time. The Confederates held every round that they could spare from their cannon at the Union lines in an attempt to soften them up. And I suspect that I can't really call it an EVP because there's no voice, but the digital voice, excuse me, the electronic audio phenomena, for want of a better term, sounds exactly like a cannonade.
Do you find that digital or analog recorders have the best results, or are they just about the same?
I used to use, because I've been doing this since 1995, I used to pretty much exclusively use analog. You had to refresh tape every time. Expensive, you know? I do think, though, that excellent results come with digital voice recorders. I try my very best to use an external mic wherever possible just to reduce the noise of the actual mechanisms themselves. But no, I think you can get equally good results with either. I do know some investigators that swear by analog tapes, though, but they're harder to find. And again, there's a bigger cost outlay.
When you're doing the EVP recordings, that somehow the people bring something to it, some kind of, I don't know, mediumship talent that helps.
I think that whenever somebody experiences something paranormal, whether it's seeing an apparition, hearing a voice phenomena, or imprinting an EVP that you don't hear at the time, whatever the phenomena is, I think that there are so many factors which need to align, which is why this stuff doesn't happen nearly as often as we would like to think it does. And I think that a key component of that is not only the individual involved, whether it's a mediumistic tendency, as you suggested, that may well indeed be a part of it. But I think it also involves their mental state at the time, their emotional state, how open-minded they are, what they're thinking about, whether they're expecting something paranormal. Because we know the old saying, don't we, that the way a ghost is to try. And that's well borne out by the literature of psychic research.
Another thing, digital cameras, is that sometimes people pick up these white orbs in the picture. What do you make of those?
I think they're very easy to explain 99% of the time. The reason that the technical reason that we tend to see the orb-like effects on a digital camera is that they're almost exclusively seen when a flash is used. Most ordinary cameras, I call them what you will, analog cameras, I guess. Most of those cameras have the flash placed fairly far away from the lens. The closer the flash is to the lens, the more likely that the light from the flash will hit a piece of dust or particulate matter close to the lens, will bounce back to it, and you get your orb effect. It's very rare to see that effect in photographs where a flash wasn't used. So 99% of orbs, I think, can be pretty easily debunked based on that method alone. Was a flash used? Was a digital camera used? But we do see those light anomalies which are recorded without the use of a flash. And we do see cases in which they are seen with the naked eye, which again, the so-called orbs, they show up on the image, but they're not seen with the naked eye. So a true light anomaly that is seen with the naked eye is something else entirely. I do believe some of those phenomena are genuine, but it's a very small fractional subset of the number of reports that we get. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was reading a blog of a guy who's not at all into the paranormal, as far as I know. He's actually playing bass with a band, and he was on tour in Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And he took a picture of a cemetery. And what happened was they were building a road through an area, and they came across an ancient burial ground. And they moved all of the burials to one kind of large plot. It almost looked like they just put them all in a pit and put the earth over them. And he took some pictures in that cemetery, and where that plot was, it was like a cloud of those orbs. And his pictures around it, the orbs weren't there, and they were daytime pictures, so I don't think he was using a flash.
So in the daytime, you do have to also look at the other natural light sources that are around. You find that when somebody steps on a bush and disturbs a whole bunch of dander and pollen and insects, those kind of things also provide a good natural explanation. I want to emphasize, I'm not saying that light phenomena can't be genuine. I just think, especially when you're outdoors, that there are so many things which can mimic that effect. It's usually the case that there's a natural explanation. Not always, but usually.
And this is one of the things I like about the way you write and the way you view all this kind of thing, is you're very kind of skeptical. You don't just accept everything to be paranormal and try and label it that way. It's almost like you're trying not to label it as paranormal.
Well, I think that the paranormal explanation should always be the one that you jump to least frequently. Because generally speaking, you know, you have to rule out the possible before what's left, the impossible or the improbable, becomes the truth. But it's become my personal philosophy, primarily through investigating over the years. It's now become my philosophy of life as well, more field, that the more certain somebody is that their explanation is the right one, the more I want to avoid them like the plague. And you do not have to go far online to find self-professed experts who will tell you that these are the stages of a spirit manifestation. You know, this is a class 3 orb. You can see a face here and this and that. And they'll talk with absolute authority. But the truth is, there are no experts in this field, least of all me. There are just those that have been doing it for many years. And I think that those who have intellectual honesty are willing to say, I don't know what I don't know. They're willing to consider all of the explanations and look at many alternatives. It's those investigators, or call them what you will, that aren't willing to accept that maybe their worldview isn't the correct one, that I'm very wary of.
Have you ever had a spirit or something attach it to yourself and follow you home?
I have. That happened to me a couple of years ago. And this is funny because I like to describe myself as an agnostic. So I'm really not someone that follows a particular religious faith. I think of myself as spiritual, but not religious. Until this incident, I really didn't do much in the way of protection. I didn't really think too much about it. But if you do this long enough, almost invariably something will attach itself to you and you'll take that home. So this happened a few years ago at Christmas time during the holidays. My wife and I began seeing a shadow figure in the house, began to hear a woman's voice, and that would drive our dog berserk. Our dog would go chasing after the source of this voice and, of course, couldn't find it. And then we had a whole bunch of framed pictures on the mantelpiece fall down. They were stacked up pretty solidly, had been there for 3 months or so, and had fallen down and nearly landed on top of my cat, which is when I said enough is enough. He'd used one of his 9 lives, and I didn't want him to have to use any more of them. So I called in a good friend of mine, Stephen Widener, who is a paranormal investigator and a Catholic priest to boot, excellent at both of those things. And I expected him to give me a hard time, what with me being an agnostic / atheist, depending on, you know, my mood that day. And I said, listen, this strange stuff's going on. Do you think you could come and cleanse the house? And he said, sure, I could. I said, will it work? Because I'm not a Christian. You know, I don't believe the things you believe in. I respect your beliefs, but I don't share them. And he said, listen, this is about belief, but it's not about the specific belief. So the ceremony that I'm going to perform, it's all about intent. So I said, okay, if you would be so kind. And he did. He came over, conducted a brief ritual, went from room to room, putting the sign of the cross in holy water on the door frames, around the windows. And I followed the pattern that he was using. It was interesting. It was almost as if he was sweeping something out of my house, you know, and ended at the front door. And he said, your house is now cleared. It's protected. You'll be safe. And the activity stopped. Now, whether that's some kind of psychic placebo effect or whether he truly did eject an entity, I'll never know for sure. But all I know is it worked.
Do you come across entities that are not spirits, that are of a human origin?
I'm in the States, and this is where the D word usually comes up, isn't it? The Americans do love to throw the word demonic around, I think primarily because it's become such a part of the paranormal culture. I do believe that there are some entities that are, or I should say I believe in the possibility of there being entities that have never walked the earth in human form, that they are inhuman entities, for want of a better term. Yeah, absolutely. Do I think that's been definitively proven, though? I couldn't prove it to you, and that's purely my opinion, so take that for what it's worth.
Would you have any idea where they might come from? Or on that side, is where would a human spirit come from, I suppose?
Well, that's the key question, isn't it, with all of this stuff? Having talked to a number of mediums, they tell a pretty consistent story, and I don't mean story to be a derogatory term, but they claim that there are multiple levels, call them dimensions, realms, or whatever you would like, but multiple kind of layers of existence or planes. And on the lower planes, spiritually speaking, are where you tend to get your spiritual parasites, where you tend to get those people who are not very enlightened, you know, the thoroughly nasty pieces of work. And then as you get higher up with higher vibrations, supposedly the entities become more good in nature. That's what I've been told a great deal. And supposedly these inhuman entities thrive at the lower levels, which is why they find our realm so accessible. And again, that's purely one of the commonly accepted things that I've heard. I couldn't say for sure that it's so or not so.
Now, you did an investigation at Asylum 49. Mm-hmm. Have you got any good stories from there?
Well, we just did talk about that briefly. That's the old hospital that I investigated in Tooele, Utah. And the place is hands down my favorite one to investigate. I've gotten very attached to that location, no pun intended. And I go back at least once a year, if not twice a year. And I'll actually be going there next weekend for 48 hours to investigate. And it's because this old abandoned hospital, and it's also a senior citizens retirement home, it had so many ghost stories that I talked to former staff, I talked to former residents, I talked to former patients, I talked to current owners that have the place turned into a Halloween haunted house attraction. And just the sheer volume of stories was incredible. And it remains the only place in my career to this point where I believe I saw an apparition, which happened appropriately enough on Halloween night. I went through the haunted house as the customers do. So it was a good opportunity for me to experience it when it was in full swing. Because my theory about why the place is so active around the Halloween period is that you have tens of thousands of people that go through that attraction, and all of them are going and getting scared. I mean, that's why you would pay to go do such a thing. They go with the intent of getting a good scare. So I think that the energy generated by that emotion, that fearful emotion, acts as a power source for the spirits that haunt the location. And so I went through, and I had one or two jump scares myself. It was a great experience. And as I was coming toward the end, I saw a young girl with blonde hair. She couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 years old. And she was dressed in kind of a Goldilocks sort of dress. And she was tugging a lady in contemporary clothing, drawing her into one of the side rooms where they have additional, you know, scares set up. And this lady didn't look too thrilled at the prospect, but the kid looked absolutely gleeful. And I thought, wow, they hire them awfully young in here. Usually I would expect them to be older, to be teenagers, to work in a place like this. Didn't think any more of it, unfortunately, because I had my camera phone right there in my hip pocket. And when I went out a few minutes later, I talked to the owners and I said, that creepy young girl that you have, isn't she kind of young to be in a place like this? And they said, what girl? What are you talking about? And so I described her And the owners looked at one another and said, oh, he saw one of the girls. And by that, they meant one of the young girls that was known to haunt the hospital. There are several child spirits that are said to roam the hallways at Asylum 49, a couple of whom had died there back when it was a hospital. And I said, no, this girl was flesh and blood. She was as real and solid as you or I. I'm pretty sure that if the lights had been on, she would have cast a shadow. And besides, I saw her actually touching this lady. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, let's go to the cast room because none of the cast have left for the night. Let's go see if you can pick this girl out. So it was like an identity parade, a police lineup. I went to the cast room. I went three times around looking at every cast member's face, and the girl that I had seen was not there. So my next stop was, because everybody has to sign a waiver before they're allowed into this location, I went to the people that had the waivers signed and sold the tickets and asked if they'd let a young girl in that night with a parent. And they said no, they hadn't seen anybody that met that description.
Do you feel like you feel great about this? You're like, yes, I've seen one.
I feel bloody awful, and I'll tell you why.
Oh.
For the longest time, I've heard stories of, I've sat and listened to people's ghost stories. I love doing it, but I've always been thinking, how could you be face-to-face with an apparition, as you're telling me, and not think to pull out your phone and take a picture? You know, you could possibly solve this age-old debate by giving us that one really impressive ghost photograph. And you mean to tell me that you saw this spirit, this apparition, and you didn't photograph it? And they usually told me the same thing. It never crossed my mind. I never thought that I might be looking at anything other than a flesh and blood person. Well, I always found that to be kind of hard to believe until it happened to me. And so knowing that my phone was literally in my pocket, I had a camera at my fingertips, and it didn't cross my mind either, even though I'm in the middle of the most haunted hospital I've ever heard of. To this day, I kick myself for not taking that girl's picture.
But there's also the thing that there's so many photographs around that if you did see one that was fantastic, you'd straight away just think, that's a fake.
Well, and that's the biggest problem, isn't it, with paranormal photography these days, thanks to the advent of Photoshop and the digital age. Number one, we no longer have a negative to examine. Back when I started, you could look at a negative, you could send it to the Kodak Labs for analysis. Now, you just have the... You can examine the metadata of the file, sure, but if you're sufficiently skilled, you can fake almost anything digitally, I think. And the other problem is that we have all these ghost apps now. You can spend $3 or a couple of quid, and you can insert ghosts into pictures and the like. So you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. Because on the one hand, if it's too good to be true, then it usually is. And on the other hand, if it's just a grainy, pixelated mess, it doesn't constitute evidence.
Tell us about Malvern Manor.
Malvern Manor. That's a terrific location I just got back from in Iowa. So Malvern, Iowa is a pretty small town. It's built around the railroad, essentially. And prior to the American highway freeway system being put into place, the railroads were how people used to cross the continent. And there would be these small towns dotted all across the U.S. that basically served as rest stops. They were kind of like the motorway service stations of their day, but entire towns. Malvern Manor originally in the mid-1800s was a hotel that was built to service the railroad customers. Once the railroads kind of started to decline, or at least in terms of passenger transit, there was really no need for that hotel. And it became a combination retirement home and nursing home. So the sort of place where not just senior citizens, older folks, but also at-risk people, such as recovering addicts and alcoholics and even mental health patients, would be accommodated. That finally closed down about 10 years ago, and Malvern Manor is now abandoned. It has a pretty serious reputation for being haunted. I've seen it on a TV show called Paranormal Lockdown, and had wanted to investigate that kind of facility myself. So the owners were kind enough to let myself and some of my colleagues move in for a few days and conduct our own investigation.
And yeah, there's some great stories there. There's the one about the shadow that races down the hall.
The Shadow Man is one of the more, I say, the darker aspects of the Malvern Manor haunting. There is a nursing home wing, which is kind of bolted onto the old structure. So the structure itself, as I said, dates back to the 1800s. But then you have this more modern wing that was constructed about a century later, where they placed most of the medical patients. And to this day, it's known now as the Shadow Man's Hallway, because one of the rooms, room two, is where this tall, shadowy figure is said to appear. And the Shadow Man likes to charge at people that see him. He likes to take a run up and come storming up to them when they see him, and then disappear just inches from their nose before he would collide with them. And what fascinates me is that the owner of the manor, Josh Hurd, talked with a former employee who told him about a real resident of room two who acted in that same way. This was a very big, very tall man that used to terrify the staff there, primarily because he had a history of violence. So he was a behavioral patient with a violent past, well known for wanting to intimidate the staff there. And when the nursing staff would do their bed checks and they would check room two, then make sure he was in bed, turn around, walk up the hallway, he would get out of bed, tiptoe to the door, and come running up behind them. Never lay a finger on them, or so the stories go, but he used to love to scare the life out of them and intimidate them. And this is exactly the behavior that the Shadow Man exhibits to this day.
And there was a woman there called Gracie with multiple personality disorder. It seems like it was possible that her different personalities were haunting.
Well, Gracie fascinated me, and she gave rise to the title of my book. The book's called The Devil's Coming to Get Me, not in an attempt to imply anything satanic, but because Gracie had at least 13 distinct personalities that were recorded by the nursing staff. And there may have been many more. These are just the ones that they wrote about explicitly. And it was well known that new staff to the manor would be on duty during the day or at night and would hear a man's voice coming from Gracie's room. Gracie was this sweet older lady that was by no means manly. And it would be a very gruff man's voice, and it would repeat over and over, "The devil's coming to get me," which is a very creepy thing to say, of course. And they would say, "Well, who is the man that is inside Gracie's room?" They'd go look, and they would see that the voice was coming from her, that she was speaking. And so that alone made me fascinated with the story of Gracie and raised the possibility, or at least the question, that some of the activity which is documented in Gracie's room, you have to wonder if components of her multiple personalities have been left behind. We all know, or we'll theorize, that when we survive death, our spirit, soul, call it what you will, some part of us may well survive that transition. But if you have multiple separate personalities, truly separate, distinct personalities, do they all survive death? Because if they did, it would say something very, very profound about what makes us who and what we are, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. And it also makes me wonder if perhaps they could be possessions, spirit possession, or even if it's something to do with reincarnation and they were previous lives.
Yeah, it's certainly not something that I could rule out. I found the concept so fascinating, found the possibility so fascinating. Historically speaking, I know that multiple personality patients were often judged to be possessed because we frankly didn't know any better. And yet there are those people that look at it from the other way, that will say, well, maybe some of the people that we diagnose as having multiple personality disorder in fact have some kind of spiritual influence or attachment.
And there's also, is it a small girl called Inez?
Yeah, Inez is fascinating to me because she's a great example of what can happen unintentionally in these kinds of cases. If you look at the episode of Paranormal Lockdown, which made Malvern Manor famous, which really put it on the map, they were told the story of Inez Gibson, a young girl who, back in the early 1900s, I actually think it was the year 1900, she hanged herself, or was hanged, I should say, in a closet. And I say was hanged because she'd been given some news that she really, really did not like. Inez, when her parents separated, went to live with other family members and was told this particular day that her mother was coming back to claim her. And then that afternoon, she was found hanging in a wardrobe. Now, the coroner's verdict on that was accidental death. It's tough to accidentally hang yourself in a wardrobe. And very coincidental that that would happen as soon as you'd been given bad news. Anyway, it's also likely, I think, that the coroners were doing the family a kindness because suicide back then had a great stigma attached to it. I mean, to a degree, it still does today. Anyway, long story short, it was said and repeated that Inez actually was found hanging in a room on the second floor at Malvern Manor. And that room to this day is called Inez's room. Multiple investigators have heard the sound of a little girl running and skipping down the corridor hallway outside that room. SLS cameras have recorded these small child-sized stick figures in that room, including some that my colleagues recorded, which are pretty impressive. And the name Inez appears frequently on EVPs. So that seems like great corroborative evidence. But when the owner, Josh Hurd, hired a private detective to do some research into the backstory of the manor, he found that Inez, although she did indeed die hanging in a wardrobe, that wardrobe was not at Malvern Manor at all. She died at home several streets away. So why would this girl, who never even came to Malvern Manor, haunt the place? And one of the theories that I find most fascinating is that for years and years, this story of Inez being found hanging in that room in the manor was repeated over and over and over again in good faith. Nobody knew that it wasn't actually true. It was a piece of folklore rather than fact. And I wonder if that didn't create a thought form. I'm sure you're familiar with the Philip experiment.
Yeah, could you remind us for the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was an experiment which happened in Canada during which a series of sitters decided that they would create a ghost, create a spirit. They essentially sketched out his character, his characteristics. They determined a whole bunch of facts about this entity, this male entity called Philip. And then they decided to try and contact him via Ouija board. And lo and behold, it wasn't long before Philip, or something claiming to be Philip, began to answer them in the form of not just Ouija messages, but also knocks and raps and other rumor. So the only conclusion there is that they either contacted an entity that liked to masquerade as Philip for its own purposes, or that they created a thought form. And that's not a concept without precedence. The tulpa in Tibet is a good example. This belief that if you focus hard enough, you can create a form purely from your imagination, one that can have effects on the physical world. So it has me wondering, and to this day, I'm not sure what the answer is, whether the Inez that answers investigators and leaves them EVPs and skips along the floor, is this the spirit of a long-dead girl, a girl who's been dead for almost 120 years and somehow found her way to Malvern Manor when she died several blocks away? Is this a thought form that has been created by the investigators going over and over the story so many times that it's become almost tangible? Or is there another entity there that likes to pretend to be this little girl to suit its own purposes?
Could you tell us the difference between a residual haunting and an intelligent one?
Yeah, at least by my definition, a residual haunting is akin to a natural recording. You are dealing with an apparition or some form of phenomena that is not intelligent. So when I'm done with this interview, for example, if I go turn on Netflix and watch a TV show, I see these figures of people wandering around on my TV screen, but they're not intelligent. They are merely representations of real three-dimensional living people captured on a recording apparatus. Well, your residual hauntings are kind of like that. They're echoes or recordings of those who came before us. Whereas an intelligent haunt is something that you can interact with. It's something that, for want of a better term, has consciousness. They'll sometimes answer questions. They'll sometimes carry out acts on request. So you can't interact with the people on your TV screen, but you can interact with people in the street. And that's kind of the difference between, I think, a residual and an intelligent haunt.
Do you think that animals can see things that we can't see?
Either that, or I think that they absolutely love scaring the pants off us by staring into empty corners. I've seen too many cases in which my own cats and dogs have done that, and it kind of creeps me out a little bit. It's said that they can. It's said that they can. If you ask me what I personally believe, yeah, I believe that's pretty plausible. I don't think, though, it's been definitively proven either way.
Can you tell us about the TV show you were involved with?
I'm involved with a couple of TV shows. The first was called Haunted Case Files. We just shot the second season of that, in fact, a few months ago. In Britain, it's referred to by the, it goes by the name of Paranormal Investigators. And what it does is it takes some of my favorite cases and adds, as all of these TV shows do, big dollops of drama. They dramatize some of the cases, and I'll be honest, I think that they exaggerate quite a bit too. I give them the facts and they play things up a little bit, unfortunately, but that's the nature of TV. My latest show, which is due out, I'm hearing later this year, it's already been sold to the UK market. This one's called Haunted Hospitals, and it looks at the experiences of nurses, doctors, patients, those that work in healthcare who've had their own ghostly encounters.
Is there anywhere where you'd like to do a paranormal investigation that you haven't done yet?
You know, number one on my bucket list, because it's so hard to get into, it has got to be Alcatraz. Number one, because of the rich history that Alcatraz Island has and the sheer volume of ghost sightings and testimony, but also because you're on an island surrounded by water and it's an easier environment to control. And there's also a little something to be said for not being able to run anywhere if things start to get interesting.
Are you a glutton for punishment?
I'm not much of a thrill seeker, honestly. I'm middle-aged. My idea of a good day in right now is sitting in front of the fire with a good book. Like, I became my granddad overnight, and there are far worse things to be. But when 90-95%, I would say, of what I do is immensely boring, as any paranormal investigator will agree, it's spent waiting for the other 5-10% of the time to happen. So when things do get exciting, it really does make up for all of those quiet hours.
So have you got more books in the pipeline?
I do have more books in the pipeline. The next book that's being traditionally published is called Trail of Terror, which is my publisher's title, not mine. That looks at some of my favorite cases over the past 10 years. I'm currently working on a book about Fox Hollow Farm, which is the home of a serial killer in Indianapolis, where he committed a number of murders and left the bodies to decompose in the woods behind the house. I spent a couple of weeks investigating that case on location. It was fascinating. That will be out next September. And we're finishing the manuscript for that now. And I'm returning to Gettysburg in 3 weeks to work on a second volume of Gettysburg Ghost Encounters.
Anything after that?
Yeah, always something in the pipeline. I'm working on a book about the haunting of 30 East Drive Pontefract also, and a book about haunted healthcare. So again, patients in hospitals that have come to me and wanted to share their ghost stories. Also employees, doctors, and those kind of things.
And all your books are widely available.
They are. You can find them at, if you're in the UK, Waterstones, often Amazon is always a great source, and most brick and mortar bookstores.
And could you give us your website address again?
Certainly. It's www.richardestep, that's richardestep.net.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for giving us your time and coming onto the podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. We should do this again sometime.
And that was an interview with Richard Estep. We focus on his book, The Devil's Coming to Get Me, The Haunting of Malvern Manor. A great way to support this podcast is to join Patreon, where you get exclusive access to the extended episodes. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon. It sold over 2,000 copies and has more than 50 five-star reviews. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.